Live from the NBC News Radio Broadcasting Studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM. We're located in beautiful, sunny California. And it was sunny today, a little bit of chilly, but we're also live on Turfs Up Radio, and Turfs Up Radio is the only radio station dedicated to the green industry. And we are back from Vegas, but are we allowed to talk about it? Because what happens in Vegas?
Stays in Vegas?
Yeah.
Hey, we're allowed to talk about it. It was a great week out there, wasn't it?
It was excellent, excellent. Great Irrigation Association show. Good people coming to it. It was a great crowd.
Yep. Well attended. A lot of good things that that we saw there from both a contractor standpoint and distributor standpoint. A lot of learning, tons of classes and certificates handed out. It was a great show.
And we did a lot of recording, pre-recording. We got
did.
A lot for the ag stuff, which will be next week. And we've got a lot of different people, not only from the United States, but we're having some people from Israel. Mm-hmm. We're going to be on. And we also have some people from Saudi Arabia that's going to be on.
Yeah.
So it was a great show. We had some good times with good interviews, and I'm very excited about that.
Me too.
So anyway, we missed this next person because we were away and she was busy, and and we're catching up with her. And she's our most wonderful, how do I say this, just the best all-around smartest water person of news in California and possibly the world. She's going to branch out and do the world. So she's the purveyor of Maven's Notebook, Miss Chris Austin. Welcome to the show.
That's the sound of my head.
Blowing up.
There won't be sun in Southern California tomorrow. My head will be blocking.
we missed you. We were so busy, and I know you had some things to do, and I'm glad we're reuniting again. Isn't there a song?
Yeah,
Reunited. And
don't make him sing, Chris, please.
No. Well, he can probably sing because, you know, like me, we used to be like something. But
He can sing. He can. Me, myself, I can.
Let me know.
Yeah.
There's actually, you know, I've been requested. No, just don't sing. Bounce the word. No.
Ask my shower.
Yes. People ask me to sing. I say I can carry a horse farther than I can carry a tune.
can you tune a fish?
No, and I can tune a piano.
Okay, there you go. So what's great happening in the water world of California?
Well, you know, last week I got to attend the Aqua Conference, which was held in San Diego. And I just got to say, I took the train to San Diego. I actually got on Metrolink up here in Santa Clarita, and I went to Union Station. And from there, I went down on the train to San Diego. And it was a really nice way to travel, I got to say. It is not like an airplane. I mean, the tray table you have to pull out. It's actually set up so you can pull it out to you. You know, it's great. Leg room, my word, as much as and I'm a tall woman.
Yep.
So I highly recommend the train.
I love the train.
But anyways, I went down to the Aqua Conference in San Diego, and, you know, some of the big items of discussion were like the voluntary agreements, which are this idea that they have in the area north of the Delta and in the Delta to kind of work out a plan for the fish and for the water. And it's been in the works for a year, and they were due to give an update like at the end of October, I believe, and they said they needed some more time. So we're all kind of waiting to see what is the outcome of the voluntary agreement. The environmental people have said in a letter probably about 6 weeks, 2 months ago, that they were very unhappy with the way things are progressing, because part of the reason why they entered into this voluntary agreement is that these water districts in Northern California and other interests, they want to create some habitat for fish, which is desperately needed, and they kind of want to trade habitat for flow. So they're trying to, you know, minimize how much water they give up and sort of replace that with habitat. And that's kind of a bit of a question because if you don't have enough flow in the river, the fish won't use the habitat. So it's kind of like, you know, a catch-22. So, and they're trying to figure all this out, and they need some more time, which is not necessarily a surprise. So, but there was a lot of talk about that and how important collaboration is. And with someone from the State Water Board pointing out that if the voluntary agreements get approved, that's a much quicker way to really be able to start enacting some solutions on the ground rather than their traditional approach, which will result in a lot of litigation.
Right.
So we'll see where that goes. The other item of discussion was the governor's water resilience portfolio, which he started the process back in, I don't know, August or September. And he was saying that the administration was saying they were going to put out a draft of this by the end of October. And from the impression that I got is that, well, now they're hoping, you know, to get it done by the end of the year, but they're not sure. But what he's essentially got, what the governor has in his hands, is a wish list, a Christmas list from every water stakeholder group in the state. He's got it all sitting there in front of him. Environmental groups, ag groups, the state, everyone's put in their list of things they want. And he's got to sort that out. You know, and this brings to mind something that this gentleman named Phil Eisenberg, who used to chair the Delta Stewardship Council, he said this many years ago. What was going on was a group of people in the Delta of all these varied interests had got together, and they just kind of said, well, what projects would we all support? And they came up with a list, and so they came in front of Phil at the Delta Stewardship Council, and they were like, here is our list of projects we all agree on, and look at us, we're singing kumbaya. We are so happy here, us and our group, and here's our list of projects. And so Phil looked at this list, and he said, well, how much do all these projects total up to? Oh, they said about $2 billion. And he's like, so what are the priorities here? And the group said, well, we didn't want to go into priorities because then we'd all be arguing. And so he looked at them, and he said, you can't give a legislator a $2 billion list of things you want. You have to prioritize.
Yeah, they need a plan.
They don't know what to do with this.
Yep.
So I think about that, and I think the governor is sitting here looking at all of this stuff and trying to figure out how to prioritize, and it must be quite a difficult task. So
don't these
color me surprised, it's not ready yet.
Don't these people work with the staff of the governor, so at least they have some communication back and forth before they show up at this and then drop it on them?
Well, you know, he asked for it. He put out this executive order, and he said, give me your list. So, and we're taking public input from groups, from regular people. Here's a website. We're going to travel the state and listen, and that's what indeed they did do.
And they brought brought the tired and poor back to him, and now we're stuck in this position.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, I mean, everybody got on board, and I mean the environmental groups. Some people tried to sort of consolidate their requests, so that like a lot of the environmental NGOs sort of got together and they came up with their list. So there's only just a handful maybe from them. And the water interests, the stakeholders, the ag people, the San Joaquin Valley Blueprint. I mean, everybody just, because he invited it. He said, bring it on. So guess what they did? And now he's got to figure out what to do, and this is no easy task.
No.
And you know, I think my personal opinion is I think he sort of came to this with this fresh face idea that, you know, he can figure this out, and if we all just sit and talk to each other, how happy we will be, and you know, we can come up with these win-win solutions. And you know, people like to say it's not a zero-sum game, but you know, it kind of is.
Yeah.
You know, I think when we tell ourselves it's not a zero-sum game, we're just trying to, you know, give platitude.
Well, he should have brought the Doritos and beer, and maybe that would have got him a little bit more excited to do it. I just think it's a waste of. Oh, we have Doritos. We have
Frank's
actually Doritos.
Doritos.
Our engineer is showing us through the booth here. He's got a bag of Doritos. So, do you like those? This is Frank, our engineer in the back, and you can't see him, but he's got a green Levi shirt that glows in the dark. And
so anyways, I got to tell you what the big hot story is, though, on my blog this week.
Are we going to talk about the water grab?
Oh, no. Yeah, water grab.
Give us the dirt. Give us the dirt, but give us the water.
Well, I'll tell you. You know, I have this category that I sometimes include on my blog. It's called the And Lastly, and it kind of goes at the end, and it's for the offbeat and weird and funny and sometimes off-topic things that I find. I really try and focus the blog on stuff, but when, you know, other stuff comes along, I put this in. But I came across this piece that I just had to add. And it was a story about how up in Northern California, a beach got inundated with what they call the penis fish. I know it's a family show, I know, but I'm using the correct anatomical thing.
Yes.
And if you look at it, you would think that, like, it was Lorena Bobbitt on steroids. I mean, it's actually quite accurate. And actually kind of gross to tell you. But the deal is, you know, I mean, marine creatures are so amazing. And some of them are just so weird. And this is what this really is, this penis fish. It's a worm, a marine worm, about the correct anatomical size that burrows into the sand and sort of lives in the sand and, you know, sort of has one part that reaches up and gets its food in. And what they think happened is, you know, they had a lot of heavy rains and heavy waves that eroded the sand and sort of exposed a whole bunch of these, like, worms. And so if you look at the picture, it's pretty amazing.
Just so you know, everybody here in the studio, except for me, is on their cell phones looking this up and looking at the pictures.
Yes, Bay Nature Magazine. Actually, if you type in penis fish, you know, it comes right up. I checked it in Google.
Wow.
And now I'll warn you, you take a look, you may want to wish you hadn't. You know, some people were like, I kind of want to unsee that. Well, yeah, you can.
Oh, God, Chris.
Yep.
Guys, yeah, guys,
yeah.
It's too late, Chris.
Well, I warned you. I warned you.
Well, see, we're not showing it on the video broadcast, so that's a good thing. But if anybody wants to...
Don't post that on the video, Frank.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. It's somehow X-rated, although it's just nature. You know,
no.
Sometimes nature can be pretty X-rated, you
yeah.
know.
I never heard of that.
It can be pretty
nasty. That kind of worm.
Me neither.
So, oh, well. That's the way it is. We live every day to hear about stuff like that.
It is. So, you know. another interesting byline on your blog today, on the blog, but on the website, was this note, and I'll read it to you so maybe you can explain. It says, quote, "Can salmon eat their way out of climate change?"
Ah, yes. This is very interesting. I had heard about this, that, you know, when climate change, one of the things that's happening is making the water temperature warmer in the rivers and the streams, because the air temperature is warmer, and that transfers to the streams. And they have found, you know, that extra temperature stress to a certain point on fish can be made up for if they have more food than they might usually eat, because
right.
their bodies are burning up a little bit more. So if there's more food, then it might be a way that they can buffer a little bit against climate change.
Yeah, it's like a balancing thing, right?
Yeah. It's like, you know, And there's a lot of potential there, but, you know, it's only going to work up and to a point, you know, because temperature will become lethal at some point for the salmon. But it's one thing that is hopeful. And one of the things that they've been working on for the past, decade or so, is they talk about the delta as being it's starved in terms of nutrients and fish food and things in the water. They say it's not a productive estuary, although others have come and said, well, that's, you have all this invasive water hyacinth growing around, so it's hard to say it's not productive. Mm. But at any rate, when it comes to food sources for fish, they can be starved for food. And these are the little bugs and copepods and zooplankton that float around in the water. One of the reasons for this that they've come to understand is there's some invasive clams that have come into the estuary, and these clams are filter feeders, meaning that they bring in the water and they eat up all of that fish food themselves. Mm. And that is where a lot of the food sources have gone to. So they've been doing a lot of projects to try and figure out how to get more fish food into the estuary. And this ties into the work that we've probably talked about here on floodplains,
mm-hmm.
you know, because in the past, the water used to flow across the land, and in flowing across the land, it went a little bit slower when it wasn't all cultivated and graded. But as it went across the land, it would pick up and generate the algae and things for the food web. And then we went and we channeled off all these fields, and we stopped that water flowing across the land into the river. And so, you know, there's been a lot of work and a lot of experimentation on how they can get this water that sits on the land to get it into the river. So they have done some projects where they have widened certain parts of the river so that it can sort of flood a floodplain area off to the side. They've done some work with flooding rice fields and letting the water sit there and then flushing that water into the river to put food into the river. So, I mean, there's a lot of work being done on this, and, you know, a lot of it is happening in the Sacramento Valley, and it's really actually kind of fun to see. There was a time back in, you know, a few decades ago where the farmers used to burn their fields after their rice fields, to burn the rice straw after they harvested, and that meant some really huge air quality problems. So then they came along, they said, no, you can't burn, you have to flood your field. And at first, the farmers were very mad about this, and they didn't want it. But then when they started flooding the fields, the birds came in rapid numbers, and they actually found that the birds ate the bugs and some of the pests that, you know, and they got them out of the ground before they planted the next rice patch. So they actually came to appreciate the birds and how that has added, you know, made their farming life easier. But also, you know, they just became bird lovers. I have driven around the Sacramento Valley with farmers, and they have this card up on their visor, and they can stop and pull it down, and so they can identify what birds are in their fields. And I'm not kidding. They're excited about this.
Farmers/ornithologists.
It's interesting. I forget the name of the magazine I get. It's a farming magazine. And I've been reading it because it has some really interesting things about insects and what they have to do to their fields after the crop and what they should plant and so forth. But, you know, this whole thing is getting to be, for small farmers, it's getting to be really high-tech farming now. And I see a lot of the smaller family farms can't absorb the costs to get into that new technology, which will help them. And now you're seeing corporate farming is becoming a big deal in the U.S.
I just want to know if you wear overalls when you read your farming magazine.
No, I don't.
You know, one of the biggest challenges to the farming industry is that the average median age of a farmer is like 63. I mean, it's old. Sorry, apologies to all the farmers that are listening. But, you know, there's not a lot of young people that are going, hey, I want to go, you know, work on a farm.
No.
And this is why we have the growth of corporate farming.
Right.
If we had enough people interested in doing it, then they would. But, you know, it's not easy to be a farmer.
No, I can.
And I really respect the ones that get out there and try.
I honestly agree with you on that. And reading, you know, it's called Successful Farming and the magazine. But what I am getting really interested in is, you know, you said, you know, the average age is 63 and such. I think there's tons of jobs available in the new beginning with all this new technology to hire people come in. And we talk like companies from Bayer, you know, the ones who make aspirin. They're big into chemicals and things for growing food and things of that sort. All this new machinery, all these new sensors that they use, not only to measure the ground sensors, but the canopy sensors and above. I mean, there's so much. Yeah, there's so much technology that's out there. I think the universities and even the high schools should start bringing back some of these classes to teach kids on how to do these or what to look for in a job, because some of these jobs are, it's really fascinating, you know, reading all of these things and what's happening and things are being developed, and yet there's such a shortage of people. And even as you know, in the water industry, there's a lot of people who've been in that business for a long time, and a lot of them are at retirement age, and there's not a lot of backfill for those positions.
That's right.
So,
and, you know, they really need, we really going to need wastewater treatment operators and, you know, drinking water treatment operators. And the one thing that I really want to point out is that those are good jobs, very stable.
Yep.
A city doesn't get to say, you know, we are cutting our budget. We can only process 100,000 gallons of sewage this year. Yeah, I mean, they don't get to say that, right?
Right.
So it's a really stable job. And for anyone out there, you should know it's a two-year degree. It's a community college degree. You don't have to go to school for 4 years to get it.
Right.
And these are good jobs with benefits and lots of job security. So I just want to encourage anyone out there that has, you know, a need to find a job or has any interest in this, go to your community college.
Absolutely.
Jobs are available, Chris, right?
Yes, absolutely. They need you.
Yeah, the food business isn't going out of business. So
yeah, really.
With more people, we need that.
I think we're getting up close to the break here, Chris. So, hey, great to hear your voice and have you back on the segment again.
And remember, for all the listeners, please go to mavensnotebook.com. If you want to become a subscriber, do so, or a contributor to that. It's a great source for everything you want to know about California news, even though we broadcast all across the country and the world. But we still have a big audience in California. We like to cover that as well. So, Chris, thank you very much. We'll talk to you probably in 2 weeks from now. Or actually 3 weeks, because we probably won't see you for Christmas.
2 weeks is Christmas.
Yeah. So, anyway, you have a Merry
Happy
Christmas.
Happy holidays, everybody.
Happy right holidays, and stand by for our second half of The Water Zone.
KCAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, K292 FQ Riverside, and K293 CF Moreno Valley.
If you knew there was a pipe cement that works better than the one you're currently using, is better for you and the environment, and costs the same or less, would you buy it? Well, no-brainer, right? Weldon, the trusted leader in solvent cements for over 60 years, is pleased to introduce a new line of solvent cements that does all that. Introducing the Eco Series line of solvent cements for PVC piping systems. Not only does it work great and set fast, it also has 30% lower solvent emissions and less smelly fumes, a better workplace environment when you're installing pipes. But don't just take our word for it. Eco Series products are the only solvent cements that are Green Seal certified for environmental innovation for effective performance, improved working conditions, and for use with potable water. Now available in a medium-bodied, fast-setting blue formula, 905 Eco, and a regular-bodied, fast-setting clear formula, 900 Eco. Pick up a can today from your local distributor and see, smell, and feel the difference, just like Joe Sweat, president of Sunrise Irrigation, did. He said, after using Weldon's 905 Eco, we immediately noticed the application was smooth and there was noticeably less odor than other blue solvent cements on the market. The guys love it. To learn more about Eco solvent cements from Weldon, visit the website at www.weldon.com or call the technical service hotline at 877-477-8327. That's 877-477-8327.
Time to take a water break and talk some water. Irrigation. Such a refreshing topic. As more and more markets face water restrictions, your customers may be hungry, or should I say thirsty, for water-saving products. For new installations, add options like drip irrigation, controllers that respond to weather data, pressure-regulating heads, or heads with check valves. They all provide easy ways to differentiate your bids and win more jobs. Or for an extra stream of revenue, offer existing customers upgrades like high-efficiency nozzles, rotary nozzles, or Wi-Fi-based controllers. Because when you help your customers save water, you make a world of difference for the earth and your bottom line at the same time. We'll drink to that.
Okay, we're back, and that was a kind of an interesting conversation that we had, and learned about some new kind of worm fish or
that
whatever.
That subject doesn't come up that often.
No, I didn't believe that, and all you guys are sitting there looking on your websites to see what it was.
I bet there was a bunch of people went to Google right there.
I'm sure they did.
That's for
but,
sure.
Anyway, we have an interesting guest that we want to bring on, and for those of you who want to maybe call in and ask the next gentleman, this guy's an expert we got coming in. Our lines here are 888-909-1050, or if you're local, 909-792-5222. And we have a gentleman coming on. His name is Steve Bilson. He has a degree in government and years of working in various federal agencies. He founded a company called Rewater Systems in Palo Alto in 1990. And after working 2 years as a participant on the California Gray Water Ad Hoc Committee, he sponsored Assembly Bill number 3518, which passed unanimously and resulted in the nation's first-of-a-kind state gray water irrigation law and California Water Code Section 14875. So that's pretty neat. And in 1992 through 1994, he worked with virtually every local, regional, and state building safety and health protection agency in California to help write the first state gray water irrigation code for single-family systems. So this guy is certainly an expert. Chris, what else?
Yeah, well, we also know about him is right here in California. We know he's responsible for getting more permitted gray water irrigation systems than anyone else combined. And his client list includes, I mean, he's helped clients like National Resource Defense Council, the U.S. Marine Corps, and many others like that. So a well-rounded individual.
So we'd certainly like to welcome our next guest, Mr. Steve Bilson. Welcome to the Water Zone, sir.
Well, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
You know, it's great to have somebody on who knows about gray water, because a lot of people don't understand gray water. They kind of know what it is, but they don't know how resourceful it can be. Can you tell us a little bit more about yourself, and really, how did you get into this thing? What made you choose the direction that you started Rewater, and what was exciting to you to do that?
Well, I grew up in the San Joaquin Valley, and I saw a water table dropping rapidly over the years, and when we were kids, we could dig forts and hit the water table, and now it's 175 feet deep. And that's close to about 90 million acre feet of water that's now completely gone forever. So that's a, everybody talks about the surface water, you know, which kind of runoff you get, you know, from this year's precipitation and snowpack. And, the nasty secret is that the groundwater is disappearing faster than anything. And it wasn't until the last couple of state administrations that Sacramento got it and started looking at groundwater. So back in the 80s, like, I was going, what's the way to reuse the water that we already have? Because reuse has got to be the solution. You can't create water, not cost-effectively anyway.
Yeah.
And I came up with gray water. There's a lot of options out there, and I started looking at gray water studies, and it was back before the internet when it was easy. And I rounded up about 325 studies on gray water from around the world and said, okay, what's the problem? Well, there's gray water at that point was defined as anything but toilet and kitchen water.
Mm-hmm.
And so once I separated the studies that had toilet and kitchen, put them in one pile, and studies that had everything but toilet and kitchen in another pile, it was clear that the science said that gray water without kitchen water is actually relatively benign. So I said, okay, that's interesting. It's everywhere. Any place you have a residence, you have it. And everyone's trying to grow things, and they've got a good source of water. How do you make this work? And that's when I got into the legal part of it and had my assemblyman sponsor Assembly Bill 3518, like you read.
Mm-hmm.
And a very long story short, we got the first state gray water irrigation bill passed. And then another long story short, we got all the code worked out with all the stakeholders involved, and that's a long, long list. And then I went right back to it again with the Assembly Bill 313 to do multifamily residences. And while the science was still fresh in everybody's minds, I figured I better strike while the fire is hot. And then we got a couple more years under our belt and got the multifamily gray water code in place, which is just amendments to the first code.
Mm-hmm.
So now any kind of residence can have a gray water system. And there's a whole bunch of criteria. The gray water code now is 16 pages long, but it's available for everybody throughout the state of California. And then other states started getting into it and worked with a few of those states. And there's a lot of states that now have their own gray water bills. Most of them are based on California's code, and some of them are better. Some of them are much worse, but yeah. That's how I got started.
Well, it's too bad you don't get royalties for writing the original one and then them copying you. So.
Copyrighted, right?
Hey, well, yeah.
Yeah. So Steve, we've had several gray water people on the show before, right? And talked about types of rewater systems, not specifically yours, but for our listeners, can you kind of describe what the basic function of a rewater system is, right? A lot of listeners are aware of gray water recycling systems, but a lot of them aren't used to hearing about the components and what makes it up. And let's talk about that before we talk about the markets that you're going after.
So a gray water system, there's two kinds. There's legal kinds and there's illegal kinds. And like
many things,
Yeah, and the state had many people come and testify, like from Department of Health Services, that said, "Now we know there's something like 7 million illegal gray water systems out there. We just know from all the conversations we've had over the decades with health administrators that we know they're out there, and there's no reported case of a human health risk from these systems, even though there are millions of them with collectively billions of operating hours." So we know gray water is not that big of a thing, but we're going to have this big code, so we know that nothing will happen bad. And so we'll talk about legal gray water systems, approved, permitted gray water systems. And it can collect showers, tubs, bathroom sinks, laundry water, and sometimes like air conditioning condensate or maybe RO discharge, but nothing from the toilets and nothing from the kitchen. And you need a permit to install it, except since 2009, if you have a closed washer only system that doesn't have a pump, you don't need a permit. But everything else needs a building permit.
Wow.
And so what that includes is it means you have to have code approved wastewater materials, like, you know, ABS pipe or PVC pipe or copper pipe, if the pressures are over such and such or whatever, and you have different types of components that have to be listed by third-party agencies, and the assembly methods, you know, the types of glues. I was listening to the commercial, Weld-On glue. It's like,
right.
You know, have a UPC stamp on it. You know, that could be something that is required for an approved system. So it's got to have a certain type of construction to be a permitted system. And so it needs to have a fail-safe design that's going to overflow to the sewer. Something, you know, the pump stops, electricity goes out, it'll have a place for the gray water to go. Then all the irrigation systems attached to it have to be made for gray water, and they have to, according to the manufacturer, have to be approved for gray water, and then they can't allow, their installation can't allow gray water to come to the surface. And nobody wants gray water on the surface. In fact, Arizona is the only state that allows gray water on the surface, but they're far removed from most water sources. They have no beach, and it's a different environment over there. So that works for them. But everyone else requires underground use of gray water.
How scalable are these systems, Steve?
Very, yeah.
Okay.
We've got systems that go from just a clothes washer, simple little pump system to our underground drip system with a little control on them to great big, giant hotel-sized systems. We've got some army barracks that produce about 8,000 gallons a day. For a gray water system, that's a lot of water every day, rain or shine, drought or not. You have access to that water, so they're very scalable. Most things are in between that somewhere.
So
most systems are in between.
So are these type systems I would guess, I'm just asking, is it primarily for doing this with new construction, just like when they bring potable water to homes, they got to run second pipes and everything else? Is it better to do it at the building stage, construction
rather than
stage,
rework versus plumbing?
Yeah, and can it be done, in a home?
As a retrofit.
Yeah, as a retrofit.
Retrofits are problematic. You have slab floors where all the pipes are already in the concrete. It's impossible. If you have a raised foundation, single story, then it's possible. If you don't have stem walls and all sorts of air conditioning conduits and stuff underneath there to block you, it's theoretically possible to access some of the gray water sources. But if you have a two-story, all the water upstairs is already plumbed into the sewage system, and it's brought down the walls and sewage, so you can't get to the gray water. Mm-hmm. You're doing a major remodel, and you have access to all those shower tubs and clothes washers that you want to capture the water from, maybe during the remodel. But just to take a standing home, existing home, try to retrofit, it's very problematic.
Yeah.
Except for just the clothes washer. But that clothes washer, you talk about that little J-hook on the back of the clothes washer discharge, it goes into the downspout right behind the clothes washer.
Mm-hmm.
You just lift that out, and now you've diverted your gray water. You can put that, you squirt it into some tank where you can pressurize it and send it out to irrigation. So that's pretty simple for a clothes washer only system, but not so much on retrofitting an existing home.
Can you tell us a little about, I would assume this all has to still get filtered in some way?
Yeah. What about the yuck factor,
it's,
right,
yeah,
that people thinking thinking about here? I know our listeners are.
Well, what about all the lint comes in the washing machine that goes out down the drain?
And the hair. That is the big one. Yeah, that's the debris source. You have, and most of that comes from the clothes washer.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to have a good filter. And the only types of filters we have seen that are worth a hoot are sand filters. And because you have thousands of these little pieces of rock, and the hair and the lint will be forced on top, but it won't wrap around anything. If you have a screen or a disc filter or something like that, hairs will wrap around it or go through the screen and wrap around it, and then you can't get rid of it. It renders the screen or the disc filter totally ineffective. They're worthless. You got to get in with a razor blade and cut the stuff out.
Mm.
So with sand, everything just kind of rests on top of the sand bed, and you backwash it from the bottom, and it lifts the hair and the lint and other debris out, and you send it out to the sewer system. It's just how our system is plumbed, so we do that automatically with our controllers that control all that stuff. So it's quite doable. We've done it over and over, and it's just a matter of doing it right. The irrigation portion of the system is where the water meets the dirt, and it has to be underground drip or underground some kind of other form of getting the water underground, and it's usually it's drip. We have our own emitters. They're made especially for gray water. They have a 12 GPH orifice. Mm-hmm. So the scaling that you get with gray water, which is an incredible amount of scaling, because even after you filter the heck out of gray water, has tiny little organic solids that want to coagulate downstream and line the insides of the pipes and the valves and tubing and everything, and then flake off in these little scales, and they go out, flow downstream, and they find the opening, and if it's a little 1 GPH or 2 GPH opening, it just
yep.
clogs it up, and that's the end of it.
Yep. Instant stop, yeah.
Instant stop, and I've seen more of those systems ripped out by angry homeowners and other apartment building owners. It's like, well, you should have bought a rewater system.
Oh.
But yeah, we do have emitters at work, because they will just pass those scales right into the ground. And that stuff's actually, it's fertilizer. I mean, it
sure.
breaks down real fast with the microbes in the soil. It just turns it full of acumic acid in about 15 minutes, and it's fertilizer.
Are they like, if you could tell us, is it like a flat emitter or a cylindrical emitter that has maybe two holes versus one?
Or a point source emitter?
A little cone-shaped, looks like kind of like an upside-down ice cream cone. And the pointy part sticks into the tubing, and you put them wherever you want to irrigate. It's not inline emitter. You have to poke them into the tube.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we use the blue stripe tubes. So you got a nice straight line, and they punch them into the tube wherever they want the water to come out. So maybe, you know, every landscape's different. Maybe
right.
one person has lawn, and they want them every 14 inches
right.
On center and sideways, you know, parallel rows. And if they have trees every 15 feet, they only want to irrigate next to the trees. So
yeah.
you poke them in where you want them.
Now, obviously, does that affect, you know, I would think being in the irrigation business for us, it also depends on the soil conditions, because sometimes the patterns of the
That's
water
right.
dispersion is going to be different.
That's exactly right. Yeah, you got the clay soils. You have a kind of a flat looking water distribution. You have a sandy soil. The plume just goes straight down.
Right.
So, yeah, it just depends on the kind of soil, too. So, ideally, you know, I tell everybody the biggest secret to gray water irrigation is good soil prep.
Yeah.
that's the secret to regular irrigation.
Yeah, I think I was just going to say, I think that's a general rule, Steve. So,
yeah.
I don't
yeah.
know if there's any great innovation in there. But so let me ask you another question then, because just recently we were talking about rainwater harvesting as well. So can a gray water system like we've been talking about and you've been describing, can it be integrated or somehow used with rainwater catchment systems?
Well, we have done that, and that's a big hit with the LEED crowd. You know, the
sure.
leaders in the, you know, LEED, Green Building Point System.
Yep, LEED.
And yeah, they have a lot more money than most people typically, and it's not real cost effective. That's an understatement. It's not cost effective by anybody's standards. What you have is you have a lot of rain when you don't need it, so you have to store it. And so you have to have a big, giant tank. And that big, giant tank, no matter how giant you want to make it, is going to store water one time until the rainy season's over, and then you can use the water. So maybe you spend, you know, $50,000 for a 50,000 gallon tank. That takes a long time to pay for just that tank. And, you know, there's the engineering to it and everything. But
sure.
we do these all the time. You can get up to 12 points for a gray water system that's backed up with rainwater harvesting. We go through the sustainable sites, water reuse, go through all the various points that you check off. 12 of them. That can take you from a silver to a platinum with one system. So for the LEED people, it's a very big deal, and they get the greenest home on the planet. You've got almost no irrigation runoff because it's all underground drip. You've got very little just rain runoff because you have a dry surface. You're capturing all the water that comes onto the property, or at least onto the building. And we're using the water you imported through the gray water system. It's just as green as it gets.
Yeah.
Well, got to have a lot of green to afford it, though.
Yeah, you got to a little green to get the green. So.
Well, on your irrigation system, do you use standard type? Is your controller a standard type, or do you incorporate other devices to make it a smart controller so it knows when to water? And do you use, you know, ET information, or do you use turf sensors and things of that, soil sensors?
So what we do is we have the Irritrol Total Control. It's got a completely different chip in it and some different hardware.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you know how to operate a Total Control, you know how to operate this controller. And we did that for a reason, because a lot of people know how to operate the Total Control.
Yeah.
And so what it does, different than the Total Control, is it's starting and stopping based on when there's water available in the gray water tank.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if someone takes a shower in the morning, that water becomes available. The controller starts going through the irrigation program and starts and stops and does this throughout the day. Someone does laundry, someone comes home, takes a shower. It just keeps using water through the program as it's produced throughout the day. At midnight, if it doesn't make it through the irrigation programs, there's four independently operating programs. You all know the Total Control.
Yeah.
Right.
You can then, it will automatically, has a feature on it, will automatically supplement the balance of that day's irrigation schedule with fresh water. If it's hooked up to a rain harvesting system, it will automatically supplement that day's irrigation program with stored rain. We also have a third backup on there where we have a fresh water connection that if they say they go away on vacation, there's no gray water, it's the middle of summer, there's no rain, it'll just use city water. So they have their irrigation demand met no matter what. Uses gray water first, rain second. Worst case scenario, uses city water as a backup.
As a backup, yeah.
So, yeah, we have, that's the system that we have in the green market, the lead market. And like I say, it's the greenest thing going. But if you just take the rain harvesting out of that equation, you just have gray water, then it's backed up with city water. That's what we sell the most of by far.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about, you know, you said it takes some green, right, to get green, right? And so we know the whole conservation and sustainability issue that's pervasive right now in our industry and very apparent to homeowners and commercial customers and the same. So talk for a minute. Because there are some benefits, Steve, right? There really are benefits to this, not just to the homeowner and the commercial user, but also to the environment. So can you speak to that for a little bit?
Yeah, there's benefits that go all around with the gray water system. Like you say, there's upstream environmental benefits where you're not taking water from whatever, the Delta or Colorado River, whatever. It's just you're taking a third for an average home, it's a third less water. And there's downstream benefits. You're not producing that wastewater. It's not going down to whatever, Hyperion or wherever the wastewater treatment plant is for you locally, or it's not overloading your septic fields and like all the Malibu crowd, you know, and goes down to the creek and, you know, out to the oceans 2 days later. It's used on your property. So all the organic stuff we talked about earlier, turning into fertilizer, that stays on your property and it grows your plants. So there's all sorts of environmental stuff that's good from gray water irrigation. You use when you use less water, you also use less electricity to send that water to your house.
Right, power and energy use.
19% of all of California's energy goes to pumping water around the state. That's a huge, huge number.
Yeah,
and that's from the
California
Energy Commission. And so that's a big number. That means less hydrocarbons for having to pump that water. Air is cleaner. It's just an environmental smorgasbord of good things. So monetarily, there's that too. We kind of touched on that. But, you know, a single-family home, average 3.2-person home, is going to produce about 47,000 gallons of gray water a year. That water is going to be used underground in drip. So that's about at least 25% efficiency factor. So that bumps it up to about 58,000 gallons of water equivalent a year. That's no small number. You know?
No, that's huge.
You could take an ET controller, and can you get another 58,000 gallons a year out of that? No way.
Yeah.
So you know, we have a smart controller. It's just not an ET controller.
Right, right, right.
Well, let me ask you this, because I've heard different, you know, there's all people on both sides of the things, and the gray waters, I think, is an important factor to everybody. You should know what to do with it. But I also heard some water agencies or some city utilities saying, well, you know, they need the water going into the sewer to push all the junk that's in there out of the way.
I think we're probably a little ways away from taking too much water out of that. But
has that been a concern? Has that come up in any of the?
I hear it all the time from the wastewater districts. Yeah, the reality is they don't want the waste. They don't want the good, easy gray water taken out because they can sell it. Mm. You know, they take it down to their reclamation plant, and that's easy money.
Yeah,
there's not enough gray. If you could retrofit all the homes out there, but as we talked about, you can't.
Right.
And that would be something. The new construction is just a small percentage of the total wastewater flows going down to the sewer plants.
Mm-hmm.
Every single home that's going to be built from now on had a gray water irrigation system. You'd end up putting like 10% less water down the pipe, total down the pipe, after everything was built out in California 100 years from now. So
right.
It's just not a factor.
Has any utilities offered any rebates for systems like you have?
Well, the city of San Diego, where we were rewater systems was for 13 years, has $1,000. And that's for a single family home or apartment building, whatever, they give $1,000. And they've determined that that's worth it. Actually, you turn it was worth about three times that much to them,
mm-hmm.
but they give the owner $1,000 rebate for it. But it's kind of ironic that the water districts have most of them. You see, the California River Water Conservation Council has, you know, the BMPs. They don't want to adopt gray water because it's a big ticket item. There's, you know, we're talking, you know, 58,000 gallons of water. Or, you know, apartment building, maybe you have, you know, 1 million or 1.5 million, you know, a year in water. They're going, what's that worth, you know, to the water district? You know, it's like, we don't want to give these guys $30,000 for a gray water system.
Hmm.
It's a big ticket item. So the water conservation programs will give you $50 for a rain barrel. But
yeah,
they won't give you $50 for a gray water system that saves, you know, 1,000 times more water than a rain barrel.
No.
So it's coming. It's coming, though. You know, they've used a lot of technologies, and they've picked all the high-hanging fruit, and there's this great big fat one sitting at the bottom of the tree called gray water irrigation. If they ever want to pick that one, they'll have a big deal. We went through the State Water Resources Control Board, State Revolving Fund program,
right,
and they determined back in 2000 that this is the least expensive form of new water they have ever seen.
Oh.
And, I mean, it's when you're talking about, you know, $500 an acre foot, that's when you run the numbers, and it can be cheaper than that, too. It depends on the local water rates and the local wastewater
right.
rates. But, you know, you can't touch it. And, you know, water district, like, we're looking for cheap water.
Right.
Oh, we can get this? Yeah, that's a
right.
screaming bargain for the water districts.
Right.
They save because they don't. There's less pumping for them, less wear and tear on the machinery. They have to buy less chemicals, both on the water side and the wastewater treatment side.
Right. Well, Steve, we got about a minute left here, so we want to give you a chance to tell people how they can learn more about your product, where they can go to get educated. So tell our listeners where they can find out more.
Rewater.com, rewater.com. Yeah, we've been doing it for 30 years. We've got a website that has a lot of information on it. And just go to rewater.com, and you can go through, you know, links for studies and links for projects, links for this and that. It's all there.
Great. Well, Steve, thank you very much for coming on. I'm sure for me it was great to listen to this and learn more about the rewater systems, and I think our listeners are going to like it. And so one thing that we always tell people something at the end of the show, but we're coming up with something new. So what we want to tell everybody is
keep our planet blue.
Good night, everybody. We'll talk to you next week. Have a good week.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
It's time for NBC Radio News on KCAA Loma Linda. Brought to you by Green Kong Dispensary, the Inland Empire's finest curated medical and recreational dispensary. Google greenkong.com.